It's my pleasure to introduce Myra this morning after a week taking off from the Lenten series. We're now back on track and everything is fine. We welcome both Myra and Julian to our class. They've been here for 2 years, but it seems like yesterday that they joined us. But they live in Marietta, and they moved to Marietta 28 years ago in 1989, where Julian had accepted a job as an engineering firm. I guess it was a firm engineering whatever company. And then Myra had a position at Marietta High School teaching English, which all of us, especially Linda, will tell me I need to learn more of.
It's the Spanish.
It's the Spanish, I don't know, okay. But she's now retired from Marietta High School, and she now is employed by Kennesaw University, where she is supervising student teachers as they go out and practice, and she's having her her challenges with that particular assignment. They both grew up in Florida, and Julian was a good United Methodist, and Myra was a Baptist. I mean, this is a house divided. Finally, when 2 years ago, when they came here, Myra decided that this is the right way, and she's learning a lot about it. I'm kidding you, Myra. I hope you don't mind. They have three daughters, and they have two daughters and three grandchildren. They love to travel. I think they probably have the record of the number of countries they have been to. They have been to 53 countries. Can anybody, and that is in six continents, and I've been in six, but I haven't been in 53 countries. So, there's one, you know, we always ask the teacher, what is it that, people might not know about them? Well, first of all, she said she was scared. No, that isn't the word. She is nervous about about teaching this class. She hasn't, being a Baptist, they weren't allowed to teach. And I'm teasing that. I'm sorry. Anyway, but the other thing about her is she is very intimidated by reading to a four-year-old preschool kindergarten class. She told me a little bit more this morning that they can call you fat and they call you what else, I don't know. But Myra, thank you for coming, and we look forward to your lesson. And, you know, they just got back from Israel, how long ago? Not too long
ago.
October. So you're getting a fresh look at the Garden of Gethsemane.
Thank you, George. It is intimidating. You know, I know many of you feel like I do to stand up here in front of this group. It's intimidating, but I was telling George, I think the most nervous I've ever been is the very first time I ever had to go read to my granddaughter's four-year-old preschool class. I mean, I practiced the reading, chose about a half a dozen books, went to the library and said, can you recommend some things? But they were wonderful. They were very forgiving, but they're very honest.
We're going to be equally as nice.
Oh, good. Thank you. As George said, we have been doing the study, Adam Hamilton's, I'm sure many of you are familiar with him, 24 Hours That Changed the World. And John Sharp started this 2 weeks ago, and then we had a break last week with our weekend of missions. And it's the 24 hours leading up to Christ on the cross. And so, you know, during this Lenten season,
No,
sit no. That down.
Is that somebody's gizmo?
No, that's a recorder.
Oh, that's a
recorder. Are you ready for the...
I am.
Okay. Right. So we're going to do the first one?
Yeah.
Okay.
So at the picture that's up on the board, Julian and I had the privilege of going to Jerusalem and to Israel back in October. And, oh, wait, I'm sorry. I just need to do the PowerPoint first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the PowerPoint.
All right, no problem.
We have a DVD for you. Adam sent Hamilton taking us through Jerusalem, but in a few minutes. But as I said, we were there in October, and for those of how many have been to Jerusalem, so you that's a huge number. So you know, okay, thank you. You know, I assume, I know myself, you're wandering through the town and you're not really sure where things are. Did you feel that way? That you weren't sure where you'd been and where you were going? And so this is a look, this is a picture, and I know some of you can't see it, but it's a picture of the holy city from Mount of Olives. So it's from the view we have is east looking west. And so I'll point out some of the places as we walk through this 24-hour period in Jerusalem. But like I said, it's taken, you can see the Golden Dome there, which, you know, is the holiest area there now, but is controlled by not the Christians, but the Muslims, in fact. But I will point out some places as we go through. So starting, we're going to start leading up to that last 24 hours, the Sunday before, where Christ makes the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And I just want to point out, he's coming east from, like, maybe from Bethany, where he has been staying in a village outside of Jerusalem. And he is coming in and entering through the Golden Gate. Christ made his triumphal entry by riding on a donkey through the Golden Gate on what we now refer to as Palm Sunday. This fulfills a prediction made by the prophet Zechariah that the Messiah would one day ride into Jerusalem on a colt, the foal of a donkey. The colt is a sign of peace in contrast to the war horses that are present in Jerusalem. The Romans are occupying Jerusalem at this time, as we know. Religious authorities, upon hearing the praise of the people as Jesus enters, are angry and confront Jesus. Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Jesus responds, I tell you the truth, if they kept silent, the stones would cry out. Jesus weeps as he approaches Jerusalem, saying, if only you had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. On Monday is the cleansing of the temple. According to Mark, Jesus enters the temple courts and is disappointed at the commercialization of religion. In response, he begins overturning the money changers' tables and driving out the animals. You recall that everyone is coming into Jerusalem for Passover, so people are buying the animals for sacrifice. John talked to us about this a couple of weeks ago. And the religious leaders, fearing being caught, that Jesus might be trying to plot an overthrow, or in trying to get along with the Roman occupation, they plot to get rid of Jesus. Tuesday is paying taxes and giving tithes and predicting the future. Jesus is confronted by the religious leaders. They ask, who gave you the authority to do these things? He has no religious training, nor holds any official religious office. He is stirring up the people with his revolutionary ideas. And so Jesus is tested for these revolutionary intentions. The Pharisees ask him if the Jews should pay taxes to Rome. And Jesus holds up a coin and responds, whose likeness is this and whose inscription? The crowd responds, Caesar's. And Jesus declares, then render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. He says, I tell you the truth, not one stone will be left on another, predicting the destruction of the temple by the Romans 40 years later. Wednesday, Jesus' anointing and Judas' desertion. Jesus and his disciples remain in Bethany, a small village outside of Jerusalem. Jesus is anointed with expensive perfume by an unnamed woman, and it is questioned by Judas and the disciples as they feel the money could be better spent on the poor. Jesus' response to this is, the poor you will always have with you, but I will be with you only a little while. Whenever the gospel is preached, so will what this woman did be told in memory of her. Judas then leaves and informs the religious authorities of his willingness to betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And finally, we arrive at the beginning of this 24-hour period. This is the day of preparation for Passover. Jesus sends Peter and John to Jerusalem to make arrangements for their Passover meal, and the disciples and Jesus gather in the upper room to celebrate Jesus' last Passover meal, or as we refer to, the Last Supper. And John talked to us 2 weeks ago about that Seder meal that, you know, it probably went from like 7 o'clock at night until midnight, many, many portions of it, and all of the symbolisms of the Passover. The meal is served, and Jesus, in an act of humility, washes the feet of the disciples. He performs communion, and after the meal, he offers the third cup of the wine of the Passover, known as the cup of redemption. He says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." This is a reference to the prophet Jeremiah, who predicted a day when God would make a new covenant with Israel. The disciples and Jesus make their way to the Mount of Olives to sleep. And I just want to, for those of you that can see this, I just want to point out where they were. This, the upper room is over in this area. So they make their way down around the wall through the Kidron Valley. And this is the Garden of Gethsemane over here, Mount of Olives. You can take a look at it, those of you that can't see it. So they're going to Gethsemane rather than back to Bethany to sleep, and of course for Jesus to pray. The choice has symbolic value. According to the prophet Zechariah, God would one day stand on this mount just before delivering Israel from its enemies. And I found it interesting when we were in Jerusalem that in this Kidron Valley that separates the Mount of Island Mount of Olives from the Mount Zion. Is a huge cemetery. Those of you who've been, do you recall that? And this is because, they wanted to be buried there. There's the Muslim cemetery, there's the Jewish cemetery, because this is the place that, where Christ, when he comes back and he calls us home, and they want to be as close to that spot as possible. So it's, you know, it's very symbolic there. Gethsemane, which means oil press, refers to the olive oil production done on the mount. And Jesus warns his disciples that they will soon deny him. Peter declares, "Even if all of these fall away on account of you, I never will." And Jesus replies, "I tell you the truth, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. While on the Mount of Olives, Jesus prays one of his best known yet least understood prayers. "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. However, not my will, but yours be done." In what sense Jesus' will could be at cross purposes with his Father's will has been a point of ongoing theological debate. His words communicate his deep anguish at this approaching death. This anguish is further underscored by Jesus sweating what appears to be drops of blood. Jesus prays 3 times for the cup to pass from him. And our author, Adam Hamilton, offers some possible reasons for Jesus' distress and anguish at this time. Hamilton says possibly Jesus may have experienced anguish because he was wrestling once again with the tempter, as he had been in the wilderness, tempting him to pass this up, ask his Father to permit him not to have to go through this. Another possible explanation for Jesus' anguish is his knowledge of Jerusalem's fate. Possibly he is worried that if he died, most would not see him as the Messiah. They would continue to search for another Messiah. They would not understand that God wanted them to love their enemies, and they would await a Messiah who could lead them in attempting to overthrow the Romans, because many of them were looking for a leader that would, you know, get rid of their oppressors. Finally, Hamilton says Jesus is responding as a fully human being. Hamilton states, "What would you be feeling if you knew that within a few hours you would be tortured, publicly humiliated, and then subjected to one of the cruelest, most inhumane, and painful forms of capital punishment ever devised by human beings?" Jesus tells his disciples to keep watch while he prays, and they all fall asleep. Judas approaches and betrays Jesus with a kiss. Jesus is seized as the leader of the revolution, and Peter, in an attempt to save his master, takes a sword and cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. Jesus rebukes Peter, "Those who live by the sword will die by the sword." He reminds his disciples who has ultimate control in the situation. Don't you know that I could ask my Father and he would send more than 12 legions of angels on my behalf? But then how would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? Jesus then heals the servant's ear. He's abandoned. The disciples flee the scene, and Jesus is taken to the house of the high priest for questioning. I think the message, Adam Hamilton, from the Garden of Gethsemane, this chapter that's on Garden of Gethsemane, he points out that just as Jesus experiences mental suffering and anguish as a fully human person in the garden, as he answers God's will, we are all reminded that we have all experienced moments of anxiety related to answering God's call. Hamilton explains that Jesus teaches us that it's acceptable to tell God what we hope and desire, remove this cup from me, but that our final words and our prayers should be those of trust and submission to God's will. Hamilton points out that we as Christians know what it's like to sense that God wants us to do something we do not want to do. And I think we probably have all been in that situation where, you know, to volunteer or to go on a mission or to be involved and, you know, we're not quite sure. We have anxiety about it. It's not time. I don't have the money. I don't have whatever. We can come up with a lot of excuses. But Hamilton believes that the covenant prayer in the Wesleyan tradition offers obedience and trust and goes a long way to bringing peace in our lives. It begins, I am no longer my own, but thine. Put me to what thou wilt, not what I want, but what you want. And I think this is the message from this particular chapter, is to be able to give up that personal control and to permit not what I want, but what you want me to do. I'd like to show you a video that Hamilton, the author, is going to walk us through Jerusalem to some of these places and show us up close and personal for those of us that have not been there. And for those of us that have, it's, you know, it's interesting to see it again. Thank you, Doug.
It's been said that the Holy Land is the book of gospel. Walking in city streets, seeing its unique geological formations, topography, terrain, and visiting its traditional holy sites changes the history of the gospel. My name is Adam Hamilton, and I'm the author of 24 Hours to Change the World, a study of the last day of Jesus' life. And I'd like to invite you on a journey in which I'm going to be retracing the steps of Jesus from the Mount of Olives to Mount Calvary. We're going to visit the traditional holy sites that you would visit if you were walking in the streets of Jerusalem today. And each step along the way, with the book and with the video resource, we're going to be asking the questions, what is the meaning of Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection? How do I find myself in the story? And what is it that I might see and understand differently by being in this place? I'd like to take you to Jerusalem to see the traditional location of the Last Supper. Now bear in mind, as we visit the holy sites, any buildings you see were built centuries after the time of Christ. The entire city of Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, as Jesus had predicted, 40 years after his death. With this in mind, let's go to the upper room. This building was built by the Crusaders more than 1,000 years after the time of Christ. It's a fascinating place, perhaps the size of the actual upper room. It's thought by some that the upper room where Jesus ate his Last Supper is the same upper room where 120 disciples were gathered on the day of Pentecost when the Holy Spirit was poured out upon them. The room would have been the guest quarters of a wealthy individual living in Jerusalem, one who was apparently a follower of Jesus. It was about 11 o'clock at night when Jesus and his disciples left the upper room, having celebrated their Passover Seder. They took the torches, and they walked across the Kidron Valley once more down from the upper city and to this place, the Olive Grove. This is known as the Garden of Gethsemane, and Gethsemane means olive press. And it was here that Jesus came to pray, to agonize, to be tempted and tested once more, and to finally fully surrender his life to God's will. This is the oldest tree in the Garden of Gethsemane, 3,000 years old, some scholars believe. It was here for 1,000 years when Jesus came to pray on that night of his agony. And tradition says Peter, James, and John knelt at this place while Jesus went on ahead to pray in his agony. And you remember that it was here they fell asleep. Jesus came back and asked the question, could you not even stay awake for 1 hour to watch and pray with me? And that begs the question, are there moments in our lives when we, like Peter, James, and John, have have disappointed God because we were not able to stay awake and watch and pray, because we weren't careful to continue to walk in His path, or we walked away from Him when He needed us most. As we hear this story and we remember this tree, we ask that question of ourselves: when have I been like Peter, James, and John, unable to stay awake and watch and pray with the Lord? Now, when you visit the Garden of Gethsemane, and particularly when you enter the Basilica of Christ's agony, you're meant to enter the story. Look up, and you'll see the stars in the ceiling. Look ahead, and you'll see the large mosaic of Christ kneeling before a rock in prayer. And below the mosaic, the rock formation Christians have visited since at least the 300s, perhaps earlier, remembering these events. Pilgrims are invited to kneel around the rock, to touch the rock, and to remember and to pray with the Lord, "Not my will, but thy will be done." As Jesus was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas Iscariot came, leading a crowd who had come with swords and clubs from the Sanhedrin. It was after midnight. Judas came and kissed his master, a sign that Judas had given to the guards, indicating which man was to be arrested. This is the path that Jesus would have taken as he was led away from the Garden of Gethsemane and led to the place where he would be tried by the Sanhedrin at night. And so we're on our way up to the city of Zion, and we are passing through the Kidron Valley and to the Church of St. Peter Gallicanti. So this is the path. We've just walked through the Kidron Valley, where Jesus would have been led sometime after midnight with the guards from the temple with their torches. And he would have been taken up here. The disciples all had fled by this time. And when he comes up the Kidron Valley, he comes up the path from the Kidron Valley, he comes out right here at the southern wall of the temple, where he taught many times and near the teaching steps, where he had addressed the disciples and where he had predicted the downfall of Jerusalem. He continued the journey up the pathway to the lower city of David and finally to the upper city of David, to the house of High Priest Caiaphas. It was here that the Sanhedrin was meeting by night so as to not anger the crowds. It was in secret in order to silence Jesus once and for all. Now, the old Roman road still stands here, the Roman steps, and pilgrims who come this way often will take off their shoes so as to walk barefoot on the path that Jesus was walking on, to remember and to mark that last leg of his journey to the high priest's house. And somehow, as I feel these large Roman stones under my feet, I feel myself identifying, really even just wondering, what was Jesus thinking? What was he feeling? Was he winded as I am after making this journey? Was he afraid? Or was he trusting once more in the God who would deliver him? These ruins, ancient mikvah, that is ritual baths and cisterns, are thought to be the remains of the high priest Caiaphas' home. From the earliest centuries, Christians gathered here, and they remembered that Jesus was brought to this place for his trial before the Sanhedrin at night, and they remembered the place where Peter had denied Jesus three times. In 1889, this room was discovered. It had been filled with rubbish for centuries. And as archaeologists began to dig underneath the high priest's house, Caiaphas' home, what they found was evidence that there had been prisoners who were kept here. You see the place where the shackles would have been held, suspending the prisoner by their arms. And as the archaeologists began to uncover this place, they found evidence of Byzantine crosses that very early in the history of the church, Christians came here and they marked the imprisonment and the suffering of Jesus. Some even wondered whether he had been scourged himself before going to Pontius Pilate to be scourged, whether Jesus himself had his arms suspended here that night and was beaten first by the guards of the high priest. And when we read in Acts chapter 5 that Peter and John were in prison for their faith because they refused to stop speaking in the name of Jesus, this may very well have been the place where they were kept in prison. This is the dungeon, the pit where tradition says Jesus was lowered into as he was awaiting the outcome of his trial before the Sanhedrin. He could hear them debating his fate from this place. And as was common in the dungeons of the time, he would have been lowered by a rope placed around his chest, dropped down slowly into this place. He sat here in the darkness that night. Finally, when the trial was over, the rope was lowered again, and he was drawn out from the pit, and the sentence was passed. He had been turned over to Pilate to be crucified. We're standing here at the courtyard of the high priest Caiaphas' house, the courtyard outside of the Church of St. Peter Gallicanti. And perhaps my favorite part of this courtyard is the statue that was placed here in 1957. It's a statue of Peter denying three times his Lord. And the cock crowing above And it reminds us, of course, as we stand in this place, that if Peter denied Jesus and was still restored, there's hope for us when we have denied Jesus, when we've turned our backs on him or failed to acknowledge him. If there was hope for Peter, there's hope for us. I'm walking down the streets of the old city of Jerusalem, past the bazaars, the sound of church bells pealing, and the call to prayer for Muslims who are gathering on their holy day. But we're remembering the journey that Jesus made after he was sentenced to death by the Sanhedrin, bound hand and foot. He made his way from Caiaphas' palace to the Fortress Antonia, where he would be tried by Pontius Pilate. It was a 30-minute walk that day, and there were no crowds. It was very early in the morning. There were no church bells pealing. And it was a very lonely feeling as he walked down these streets. His heart was heavy because he knew what lay in store. What lay ahead was crucifixion. This is a scale model of Jerusalem in Jesus' day. The temple stood prominently in the center. The city of David, the location of Caiaphas' house and Jesus' imprisonment, was to the south and west of the temple, to the left and rear of this model. On the northwestern corner of the temple was the Antonia Fortress, built by Herod the Great as a military barracks. It became the seat of Roman authority and power in Jerusalem following Herod's death. The place where I'm sitting now is the Lithostrotos. It is a first century roadway that is underneath the Sisters of Zion convent, the Ecce Homo Sisters of Zion convent. It's thought to be a street that ran through the Antonia Fortress or adjacent to it. You can see the striations in the road which allow the water to run off when there were storms that allowed people to keep their footing and the horses as well. God alone, Hosanna. During Lent, priests daily lead pilgrims on the Via Dolorosa. And throughout the year, on Fridays, there'll be a priest who will carry a cross along the way of suffering. While trying to better understand the Roman act of flogging, I visited the Bible Times Center in Ein Kerem, one of Jerusalem's suburbs. We're focusing on the Roman scourging, and you remember that this was designed to inflict the maximum amount of pain without killing the victim. The whip would have included fish hooks, it would have included pieces of metal or glass, and some suggest that the victim was whipped first on the front and then on the back. A flagellation post would have been used, and so the victim would have found themselves bound to the post with their hands bound, their body would have been drawn taut across the post, and this would have allowed for the maximum amount of impact of the scourging upon their back. And as we see this, we remember and we visualize Jesus. If you were to visit Jerusalem, the first station of the cross marks the place where Jesus was beaten. It's called the Chapel of the Flagellation. The lintel over the door is etched with a crown of thorns, and upon entering the chapel, there are three dramatic stained glass windows. The first, to the left, as one enters, is Pontius Pilate washing his hands. To the right is Barabbas, who's being released. But in the center is the image of Jesus, tied to a Roman column, preparing to be flogged, first on the front of his body, before being flogged on his back. The most striking feature of this chapel is the crown of thorns in the ceiling. It's a reminder of Christ's humiliation that occurred near this place. I'm standing in front of Christianity's holiest shrine. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it marks the place where Jesus was crucified, dead, and buried. It's built on top of a rock formation that rises up some height. That rock formation was called Calvary because it looked like a skull, Calvaria, a skull, or Golgotha. And in ancient times, it was a rock quarry just outside the city walls of Jerusalem, where the Romans took persons to crucify them on this hill. The main road went just past it, so they were humiliated in front of the populace, but outside the city walls. The first church was built on this location around 330 AD. It was later destroyed, rebuilt. And the church you see behind me was actually built in the Crusader period in 1103. It also has been destroyed and rebuilt multiple times. The last time in the 19th century, it was destroyed by fire and then rebuilt. There are multiple different Christian groups that claim this as their own, and as I said, this is the holiest shrine for Christians. To the right is as you can see, the stairs ascending takes you to Calvary and the top of the rock formation where Christ was crucified. To the left, what you can't see from here, but to the left is the place where Christ was said to have been buried, the tomb where he was buried and then raised from the dead. I'm standing inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, standing before the stairwell that ascends to the top of the hill called Calvary, or the top of Mount Calvary. And let's go and see the Chapel of the Crucifixion. This church is shared by five different Christian denominations, and this chapel is actually cared for by the Roman Catholic Church. And here we have the Chapel of the Crucifixion. Jesus is crucified, we see in the mosaic before us. We're preparing to go into the portion of the church that is guarded by the Orthodox. It's built right on top of the rock formations that are Calvary. It's thought that there are three places in that rock where there were openings that were made that would hold the crosses. And the very center one was said to be the one that belonged to Christ. It was the place where he was crucified. Pilgrims come, they kneel and bow and step under or bow below the altar. And they can place their hand inside an opening and touch the rock formation there as a way of connecting with Jesus in his suffering and death. The Orthodox tradition makes elaborate use of icons shrouded in brass. Now, for Orthodox believers, the icons are a way of capturing the glory that belongs to Jesus Christ, who is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Now, we come to this place outside of Megiddo because it's one of the few places you can still see a first century Roman tomb with the round stone still standing in the location where it would have been. And this stone would have been rolled in front of the opening to the tomb and sealed up. And Mary Magdalene sitting grieving outside. And I'd like to take you inside the tomb so you get a sense of what these Roman tombs actually look like. So come inside with me. This tomb was carved out of soft rock, and it would have been carved to hold an entire family's worth of burials. But this gives you a sense of what a tomb would have looked like from the time of Christ. Understanding something of first century burials, let's return to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Upon entering the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, straight ahead is a large stone slab on the ground. It's called the Stone of Unction. It's a stone table that represents the place where Jesus' body was prepared for burial by Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. This particular slab of stone was placed here in the early 1800s, replacing an earlier stone slab that was destroyed. You might bow here and touch the stone as a way of remembering the death of Christ and the preparation of his body for burial. Pilgrims bring cloths and rosaries and place them on the stone, hoping to take back home with them blessings. Now, on to the right and up the stairs is the top of Mount Calvary. To the left is the Rotunda of the Resurrection. It's covered by a dome over 100 feet high and more than 60 feet in diameter. A few of the original columns from the 4th century Church of the Resurrection are still to be found here. In the center is a chapel called the Edicule, which houses all that's left of the rock tomb of Jesus Christ. It's to be found, this small fragment of rock is to be found encased in glass inside the chapel. Only a handful of people can enter this tiny space at a time, and it's thought to be the place where Christ's body was buried. Now, before leaving Jerusalem, you would want to see the garden tomb. Some believe it might be the tomb of Christ. Walking through this garden, we see the beauty of this place. There's a serenity to it. Gatherings of pilgrims come, and they receive Holy Communion at the hands of their pastors as they visit here. After having taken a tour of the garden, it's a very peaceful place. Let's go inside and see the inside of the tomb. Inside the tomb, there are places for the burial of two individuals. One of these appears to be completed. The other was not, lending some to say that the second burial place was never completed following Christ's resurrection. In the gardens around the tomb, various church groups gather with their pastors following their visit to the tomb, and they share together the story of the resurrection, and they share Holy Communion. Let's return to the garden tomb. So John tells us that it was in a garden where Jesus was buried, and it was in a garden that Jesus was raised from the dead. John tells us that to point us once more back to the Garden of Eden. And to make the point even clearer, when Mary Magdalene comes back to the tomb on that first Sunday morning, she sees the resurrected Jesus. She doesn't recognize him because he looks like a gardener. And here's the idea in John's gospel, that the gardener is restoring the garden, that what was lost in Eden when Adam and Eve disobeyed God has been restored through the obedience of Jesus Christ, through his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. He has changed everything. And that starts as individuals become his followers and surrender their lives to Christ. As we say, Jesus Christ, I wish to follow you and be your disciple. Things change in us. There's a restoration process that happens. And as the church begins to live out the gospel in the world becomes changed. Christ is the victor. He is the gardener. He's healing the garden. He's healing humanity. And he is inviting us to be his followers, to live out his gospel in the world, and to be a part of healing the world. That's the call of Jesus Christ for us. And that's part of what we remember as we focus on the last 24 hours of his life, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. 24 hours that changed the world.
Myron, thank you so much. Oh, yes. That was very special for all of those of us who have not been there. And those of you who have been there, it was just reliving the whole thing. It was a very wonderful emotional journey. Thank you very much. All of you have a great week, and Chris will be back next Sunday. Thank you.